ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Lenny.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also discuss why a plant-based diet is not only the healthiest for us humans, but the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Joshua Horwitz, the author of War of the Whales. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
According to the online newsletter, The Dodo, Santa may need to start saving up for a ticket on the Polar Express for next year. The population of one of the season's most iconic animals has been dramatically declining, and not only in the North Pole. A new study in the Journal for Nature Conservation found that reindeer populations in northern Europe, the Arctic, and North America have been dwindling for years. Scientists at Renan University School of the Environment and Natural Resources study both tundra reindeer and woodland reindeer. They found that in some areas, reindeer are showing steep declines, and it's more pronounced in some areas than others. In China, for instance, the reindeer or caribou population has declined by 28% over the past four decades. So what's hurting Santa's helpers? The scientists identified six different reasons for the trend, one of which is inbreeding due to the species' small, isolated populations. Other reasons for the decline include poaching for the animal's antlers and predators like bears, lynx, and wolves. As with countless other species, people have played a role in reindeer decline as well. Another group of scientists recently found that reindeer in Norway are facing a major threat from climate change. An increased amount of rain freezes in the cold weather and covers up the lichen they eat. The number of people interested in herding and breeding the animals hasn't dropped either. What's more, those herders who do keep reindeer have been inching closer to busy roads to cater to tourists. But this leaves reindeer vulnerable to getting hit by cars or poached by hunters. For all these reasons, the team of scientists are hoping that reindeer will get an upgrade on the International Union for Conservation of Nature's Red List, affording them better protections.
A Pennsylvania pet chain is going from supporting puppy mills to saving pets in need, thanks to new store-wide policy. Pets Plus Natural has announced that it will stop selling animals sourced from commercial breeders and instead offer shelter animals. The policy will cover its 10 retail stores and start early next year. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the chain is now getting its animals from Kentucky and Georgia shelters, organizations that have been previously approved by the Humane Society of the United States. Pet ownership in the U.S. has more than tripled since the 1970s, and there's a greater desire to help pets in need. Considering the problems associated with some breeders and puppy mills, more and more pet owners are looking to adopt, not buy. Giant chains like Petco and PetSmart have started holding adoption events in recent years, while the number of shelters increases each year. And according to the Humane Society of the United States, there are now 6 to 8 million pets entering shelters each year, every one of them looking for a new home.
Earlier this month, Mexico's Congress passed legislation that bans the use of wild animals such as primates and big cats in circuses, and also prohibits traveling shows featuring marine mammals. The Congress approved a series of changes to the General Law on Wildlife and the General Law on Ecological Balance and Environmental Protection to outlaw the use of wild animals in circuses. Those amendments prohibit the use of lions, elephants, primates, and other species in circuses. Violators face fines ranging up to $20,000. The legislation states that primates and big cats, the species most used in circuses, require special care and that frequently their well-being is jeopardized in conditions of confinement. The General Law on Wildlife was amended to prohibit traveling marine shows that use seals, dolphins, orcas, and other species.
And the struggle for marine mammal protection continues. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Joshua Horwitz. He's the founder and publisher of Living Planet Books in Washington, D.C., which specializes in books by thought leaders in science, medicine, and psychology. And Josh is the author of War of the Whales, which tells the true story of how an environmental attorney and marine biologist team up to expose the U.S. Navy's secret sonar system and the truth behind an epidemic of mass strandings. That's coming up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on ACT Radio is Josh Horwitz. Thanks a lot for being with us, Josh.
It's great to be here.
Hey, Josh, can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in animal issues?
Well, I'd have to say my first involvement was when I was a kid. I think when I was about 8 years old, I adopted a rescue hamster. My father was a neuroscience researcher at NIH, and though he was not doing any animal research, there was a lot going on at the time, and I remember there was a colony of albino hamsters that had been bred for some study. And so when I told my father I wanted a hamster for my birthday, he brought me back, he sort of snatched a Harry, the hamster, as we called him, from the pen. And, you know, before he was subjected to whatever they were subjecting them to. And I, you know, I remember at that age even understanding without anyone really having to tell me more than that we had an obligation to protect animals and that there were things going on that, you know, 8-year-olds and adults don't really want to know about, but that we kind of need to know what's going on and, if possible, do something to help.
Well, you've had a long career helping animals, and it seems like it all started from Harry the hamster. That's a great story. How did you transition from, you know, just having this empathy for animals and Harry to developing a career in animal activism?
Well, I worked in communications with both environmental and animal welfare organizations in my 20s and 30s. I'm older than that now, unfortunately. But back then, I was doing communications, fundraising, and writing work with the Animal Legal Defense Fund, with the ASPCA, with African Wildlife, various groups. And that sort of was my education in the real issues in terms of what we humans can do to help non-human animals. And I then became a publisher around 1990. I started Living Planet Books, which published both humane and environmental titles. And I did a book later on with Roger Fouts. I sort of packaged and published, co-published with HarperCollins, a book called Next of Kin with Roger Fouts, who had trained chimpanzees, including Washoe, in sign language and became a somewhat reluctant activist, but then a very fervent one, and that's a wonderful book, too. I didn't write that book, but I was very involved in it. I didn't really know that much about whales before I started this book, but I traveled with my 13-year-old daughter. It was actually a bat mitzvah present. She wanted to go see whales in the wild, and I took her to Laguna San Ignacio, which is halfway down the coast of Baja, Mexico, and it's where the gray whales come to every winter to give birth to their calves, and it's the last pristine gray whale calving ground in the world, and it's just this remarkable place where it's a very controlled environment, and a few humans are allowed out on boats, and these mother whales and their calves actually approach the boats and sort of invite contact. It's really remarkable because these are very wild animals. These are not in any way tame animals, and they take off for thousands of mile migration up to the Bering Sea, you know, as soon as they leave the cove. But while they're there, they interact with humans and, of course, with each other. And it was just a remarkable place to have my first contact, really, with whales in their natural environment. And after sort of watching my daughter have her own interactions with this calf and watching the mother kind of watching over her calf, it was just, you know, I was immediately hooked on the idea of writing a book about not just these whales, but other whales that have been threatened by humans.
I think there's a large public perception that whales have recovered from the old whaling days and that they're protected, but it seems from books like yours, which is War of the Whales, it seems like whales are still in terrible danger from a variety of sources.
Well, the reason I titled the book War of the Whales was that really the generation of whales that are the focus of my book, which is sort of 1950 to the present, were really the survivors of a millennia, at least, of organized whaling. And So it sort of seemed doubly tragic that after surviving what was really a decimating assault on them to the point where, you know, a lot of species did go extinct, many were on the brink of extinction by the post-war period, you know, that these animals were suddenly being exploited and persecuted anew by a totally different source, which was the U.S. Navy. And it's really an untold story. Some people know about this story about Navy dolphins that have been trained since the Vietnam War, but there was a whole other level of the story that I didn't know about before I started digging into this one. And I really wanted to tell that story because, you know, these whales are struggling to not just come back from whaling, but to survive rapid climate change, which, of course, has a very direct impact on the oceans. And, you know, not just military sonar, which is the focus of my book, but noise pollution from oil and gas drilling and commercial shipping, and not to mention, you know, entanglement in plastics and all sorts of man-made pollution in the ocean that's really making life tough for them.
Yeah, and I was curious when, you know, I think this has been in the news, you know, for the last several years, but when is it that really this issue of the Navy sonar testing sort of came to the surface and really became part of, you know, popular culture and people really learned about it? Because it seemed like it was quite the secretive operation for some time.
Well, throughout the Cold War, which stretched all the way from the 1950s to 1990, or 89, 90, when the Iron Curtain suddenly collapsed, throughout that period, the U.S. Navy had been both training dolphins and other small whales for combat roles, beginning in Vietnam and continuing through the Persian Gulf Wars and to the present day, to patrol harbors for enemy swimmers and to clear minefields and other operations. In addition, the Navy had spent has spent decades studying whale biosonar. This is echolocation talents that toothed whales have developed over tens of millions of years because, of course, they hunt and navigate in the dark depths of the ocean. And the Navy has a similar mission, which is to hunt for submarines in the dark depths of the ocean. And during the Cold War, it was the Soviet submarines, which were, in fact, a very fearsome enemy. But it was the Navy, really, who figured out initially that bats echolocate. They figured that out during the war, rather the Department of Defense did. And then the Navy undertook studying other marine mammals, rather other mammals that navigate in the dark, like bats, and deduced quickly that indeed dolphins and other whales, smaller whales, are what they're focusing on for their study, for training purposes. But they were really looking at trying to reverse engineer this very sophisticated form of seeing in the dark using sound that whales had evolved, and they were hoping to upgrade their own submarine detection and hunting systems, seeing what they could learn from these whales. And, you know, through tragic irony, so this was, it wasn't until the 1990s, to answer your question, that an environmental attorney really stumbled on evidence that the Navy had been developing this super sonar system that floods whole ocean basins with sound. It's called low frequency active sonar, and the Navy had never bothered throughout the Cold War. Throughout the last 10 years, they'd been testing the system and developing it around the world, had never bothered to apply for the required permits from NOAA and Fisheries Department, which you have to have under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act and other environmental statutes. They had just done this in the dark because that's how the Navy was used to operating. And so this one attorney named Joel Reynolds at NRDC really, you know, took this on as a personal crusade. And then my book, War of the Whales, narrates both that discovery on his part and then his teaming up with a marine biologist named Ken Balcom, who happened to witness a mass stranding of whales in 2000 in the Bahamas, where he was studying that population of whales. And they teamed up and took this case all the way to the Supreme Court. So the story kind of covers, you know, when it came into public view, really was that moment in 2000 when this mass stranding of whales happened in the presence of Navy war games.
As I understand it, the Supreme Court said that the military's desires to investigate the sonar took precedent over the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
Well, that's correct. The Navy, there were a series of lawsuits, and as any lawyers who may be listening know, that different lawsuits happen or are filed in different jurisdictions. This particular lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court was filed in California, and it was upheld. The NRDC won their case in the district court. It was upheld in the appeals court, and then it was the government, the U.S. government, took it to the Supreme Court, which granted cert and heard the case, and by a 5-4 decision did rule that the lower court judge had not deferred sufficiently to the national security concerns of the Navy that the Navy had expressed during the trial, saying this was necessary for national security, that the Navy be able to train in marine habitats, or for that matter, wherever they felt they needed to do that. And again, this is all about sonar trainings. This is not about the use of sonar in combat, active combat. This is all about training missions and where the Navy is going to train for sonar, and this is where the problems have been, is during training exercises in places like the Bahamas and elsewhere around the world where whales have come ashore in mass numbers.
And, you know, for someone who's really spent most of his life in the desert and not much time near the ocean, I wonder, too, if you can sort of paint a picture for us of what exactly it looks like when the whales, you know, for instance, in the Bahamas, were doing this mass stranding. What are the physical injuries that they endure during the sonar testing?
Well, the Bahamas is a good example because it's typical of where these mass strandings have happened. And what you have underwater in the Bahamas is the deepest and widest, actually the biggest underwater canyon in the world. It's about four times as deep and as long as the Grand Canyon in Arizona. So it'll give you some sense of the scale of it. And
wow.
It's 4 miles deeper. It's tremendously deep and steep-sided. So if you imagine it like an old-fashioned steel clawed foot bathtub, so obviously it's not made of steel, but it's that shape. And the Bahamas by the shore is very shallow, but it quickly drops off into this canyon that goes along most of the Bahama Islands. And the Navy had recently gotten kicked out of Vieques, which is a small island off of Puerto Rico, which they'd used as a bombing range for decades, and eventually the islanders occupied the island in protest and made it impossible for them to operate there. So they were looking for a new place to operate, another deep water environment, because these are exercises where they hunt for submarines. So they decided, well, what about the Bahamas? Why don't we try that? So this was the first time the Navy had ever done exercises there, war games, and they didn't give anyone any warning. And unfortunately, they didn't do any advance scoping to see if there were, in fact, marine mammals there, because they certainly had been alerted to the potential problem of whales in the habitats where they were training, because there had been prior incidents. So there had never been a strong physical evidence trail like there has happened here. But in any case, what was eventually reconstructed by the Navy when it was forced to investigate this, what became a very public stranding, because the marine biologist who was on site there happened to record it all on videotape and had the presence of mind to take the heads of some of the whales that died on the beach and get them into a deep freeze and maintain a physical evidence trail that really was the smoking gun, to have a mixed metaphor there. So in any case, what happened? Well, they reconstructed this, the Navy, using its own acousticians and supercomputer modeling, conceded at the end of a long investigation that, in fact, the sonar had caused the stranding of these 18 whales. And these are whales that had been resident in this canyon for literally tens of millions of years. So it's just these whales had evolved in this canyon, this deep canyon, to hunt for squid at depth. So they and the squid had evolved to dwell deeper and deeper in the canyon. So in any case, these kinds of whales, which are called beaked whales, which are actually 25% of all whale species are beaked whales, but most people don't know about them because they spend so much of their time underwater. Mm. And they are air breathing, of course, but they only come up for air about once an hour. So otherwise, they are diving at depth, which is very quickly dark because the light only penetrates about 100 feet. I'm sorry, about 300 feet, 100 meters. And below that, it's dark, and they are using their sonar to find these squid and hunt them in groups of whales who will kind of communicate with each other while they're hunting, so they're both phonating and echolocating simultaneously. And that's what they were doing on March 15th in 2000, and there was a midnight to dawn exercise where the Navy sent a battle group of five three destroyers and two cruisers using different kinds of sweeping and omnidirectional and unidirectional sonar through this canyon. So if you can imagine this 100-mile long and about 50-mile wide underwater canyon, and you have this battle group traversing the surface looking for some decoy submarines that are play-acting, you know, the enemy subs they're trying to find, and they're filling this bathtub of a canyon, if you will, with high-intensity sound, which is what sonar is. This is 235 decibels at its source, which is one of the loudest noises,
wow,
certainly in the ocean or anywhere. It's if you ever hear recordings, if you go to my website, which is warofthewhales.com, you can find actual recordings of what it sounds like. But
wow,
it's beyond unpleasant. It's so intolerable that it's
twice the threshold of pain decibel limit.
Oh, it's more than twice. I mean, 180 decibels has been established by the Navy itself as a level at which, well, divers aren't allowed in the water at 120 decibels, and because decibels are logarithmic, not arithmetic, you know, every time you go up 10 decibels, it doubles. So it's thousands of times louder than a pain threshold, mere train threshold. And in fact, so, you know, it's impossible to know exactly what happened to each of the whales, but if you can imagine these whales diving to a mile down and surfacing very slowly, because that's the only way they can avoid getting what we call the bends, which are nitrogen bubbles that you get in your blood by surfacing too quickly. So when they were surfacing, what they ran into is this wall of noise that had nowhere to escape, because sound in the open ocean will dissipate, but in a closed canyon like
this,
it just bounces off the walls of the canyon. And so it really, if you go back to the bathtub image, it just fills this closed space over the course of 10 hours, 12 hours of traversing it with sonar, just filled up with the sound. And if you look at the acoustic models that the Navy did themselves, it's terrifying to look at and consider what it must have been like for these whales to try to surface to breathe through, because most of the most intense sound tends to collect at the surface, but the surface is 500 feet. So in order to breathe, they have to go through this 500 feet of intense sound, and then they have to, of course, they take a breath and then instinctively are diving back down into the same sound field. There's really no escape. So the only escape for them was to flee the canyon for the shallows, which is, among other things, a gauntlet of sharks and reefs and all sorts of things. They've never been out of the canyon for, you know, certainly in their lifetimes, have never strayed out of the canyon because it's not safe. And certainly once they get into the shallows and run aground, the jig is pretty much up. I mean, several of them were pushed back out to sea, but they weren't seen again, and it's unlikely that they actually survived. So.
Well, you know, besides beaching themselves to get away from the sound, many of them become deaf because of the sonar, and I can think of nothing more tragic than for a beast that navigates through the world by hearing to lose its sense of hearing.
Well, they are acoustically hypersensitive animals. If you look at their brains, they are mammalian brains like ours, but their acoustic cortex is much larger than ours. They are much more acute sound animals than we are, and so. And when they did the what they call necropsies, and when they put these heads that Balcom had recovered, these specimens that he recovered and froze, he eventually carried them up to this CT lab up in Harvard, and they were scanned. And what they showed was that there were blood pooled in the brain cavity and inside the cranium, around the brain, in the ear canals. And so, you know, they'd obviously hemorrhaged. You know, that's how intense the sound was. And subsequent liver and other organ samples showed that there was, you know, nitrogen bubbles in their organs, and, you know, they were suffering, I'm sure, on lots of levels, and it's really horrible to think about. So, you know, regardless of how many whales are stranding from these incidents, you know, all of them are intolerable, and for everyone that, you know, dies, many are fleeing their habitats, their migration paths. And again, these are not this species per se, but a lot of species of whales that are in the path of Navy sonar and other industrial noise are endangered species. So for them to deviate from their migration and foraging paths can be lethal in itself.
So, Josh, what do you think would be since it is a military operation, it's very difficult for citizens to be able to be effective in asking for an end to this type of sonar activity. What do you think is the best path forward to help these whales and other animals that use sonar in the sea?
Well, one of the reasons I wrote War of the Whales was because it actually is a positive story. You know, I didn't want to just tell a depressing story about these victim whales. And the upside of the story is it really shows what initially two individuals, this lawyer and this marine biologist, and subsequently, you know, all of the NRDC members and the members of other co-plaintiff groups, which included the Humane Society of the United States, different lawsuits, and today there's an ongoing lawsuit against the Navy that NRDC is doing, and ALDF, I'm glad to say, is a co-plaintiff, and that's been filed in California and Hawaii over the recently permitted sonar ranges there. And, you know, the simplest thing you can do is join groups like ALDF and NRDC and support this litigation. And it's not just litigation. They do petition campaigns. I know NRDC has one. If you go to moveon.org, Lindia Story has a really good petition that's asking President Obama to use his powers as the commander in chief to essentially use his executive powers to stop Navy trainings in marine habitats. And I think, you know, we need to do all of these things. And the fact is, the Navy has come a long way from where it was, how it was operating back in the 90s, which was with total disregard for animal welfare. And now they sort of have sort of a grudging compliance with the law, and they're still, you know, they're still in court because they're not in full compliance. But, you know, they've come a long way. So I think it's a positive story about, you know, the effect that citizen action can have. And I'm looking to I don't know if you've heard about it out west, but they've just opened up the whole Eastern Seaboard, which is the migration path of the North Atlantic right whale, which is the most endangered species of whale left, with only about 400 left in the world. Their migration path is about to be opened up to seismic oil exploration after a 27-year moratorium. And, you know, there are always bad. You don't have to look far to find battlegrounds and people you can join with to fight these battles. And I think these are worth fighting because, you know, what can I say? This is a do-or-die kind of moment, this next few years, the next decade, for a lot of these species of whales.
And Josh, I think your book is obviously very critically acclaimed, and I think our listeners would really enjoy reading it. Can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about it and purchase
well,
it?
Well, you can either go to my website, which is warofthewhales.com, which, you know, has photos and videos and whatnot, or you can go to Amazon. It's number 24 on their best books of 2014 this year, and you can buy it at a steep discount there. Go to a local bookstore. It's available widely, and you know, I spent 7 years writing it because I really cared about the issue, and I think it's a great, you know, story for anybody who wants to be an agent of change about what it takes.
Thanks so much for joining us, Josh. It's really a great book, and we're excited to share your message and your experience with it.
It's been a treat being here. Thanks a lot.
The new year is just around the corner, and now's the perfect time to start thinking about ways to improve your health in 2015. One great way to do that is to adopt a pet. Having a furry friend leads to a number of proven health benefits for people, including physical, mental, and emotional improvements, which includes everything from enhancing social skills to decreasing a person's risk of heart attack. To find your new walking buddy, visit El Paso Animal Services, the Humane Society of El Paso, or any of our other great local rescue organizations. You'll save a life and extend yours as well.
If you need help with a New Year's resolution to eat healthier, you might consider joining the Vegetarian Society of El Paso. Visit our website at vsep.org.
You can also support the Vegetarian Society of El Paso by buying Josh's books or other items at Amazon Smile. And just make sure that you indicate that your charity of choice is the Vegetarian Society of El Paso. I'm Liz Walsh.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.